I want to show you something. See this? That's the Caspian Sea. Here's Tabriz, modern northern Iran. See that city, Ahar? Can you see that right there? Get your own map out. That's Ahar. Right down here is a little river. They call it Uzan. Spelled on this map, Kizel Uzan. O-W-Z-A-N. I don't know how to pronounce Persian words. The river flows around, finally makes its way into this delta area by Bandar Anzali, named after the old peacock throne, the Bandar-e Pahlavi, or the Shah. Well, this is an interesting river. How many of you know your Bible well enough to know that the kingdom of Israel to the north, when it describes the place that the Assyrians settled them, it names by the river Gozan, and it names one of the towns among some others. I was looking for some of the others here, because I just got this big atlas. I figured if I could find it in any of them, I'd find it in this one. And one of the towns is Habor. Habor, they settled them by Habor and by the river Gozan. Ozan is the river Gozan. And I can take you on back to the 10th century when it had the bridge name between Gozan and Ozan. And Ahar, the modern city, still occupies the site, Habor, where the tribes were settled along this edge of the Caspian Sea. Now, if you want a broader picture of where that settlement area is, it's the more modern area of Azerbaijan. Right in this area between the Caspian and the Black Sea, just south of the Caucasus Mountains. And when Esdras, it's an apocryphal book, but just as good a history as Pliny or Tacitus or Herodotus, talks of those Jews that were settled in this area. He didn't call them Jews, these descendants of the northern tribe. When he talks of them, he said they made their way through these Caucasus Mountains a year and a half. Herodotus, probably the father of history by those who want to credit classical sources as worth more than the Bible, describes the Scythians who came from this territory, who spring on the scene about the 7th century B.C., and he describes the territory in which they ruled. If you were to draw a rectangle from Moscow, Russia, right here, give me the picture. If you were to draw a rectangle from Moscow, right there, to Warsaw, Poland, and rectangular, bring it down to the Black Sea, and rectangular from Moscow to bring it to the north shore of the Caspian, and bounded on the south by the Caucasus Mountains, you would have them bounded in a rectangle up to Moscow, to Warsaw, to the Black Sea. The natural open territory that would tend to determine their area of movement is across this northwestern, northern, northwestern sections of Europe. We have them settled right here. We have Esdras saying they went a year and a half through these Caucasus Mountains to an unknown country, choosing to do that. And you have Herodotus, 200 years after they moved this way in two generations. They occupied a territory from Moscow to Warsaw to the Black Sea, and they had moved around the Black Sea, the tribes of Jetai and Moesi, to settle in the area now called Bulgaria, and became major assistants to Philip of Macedon, who preceded Alexander the Great, were the one group that Alexander the Great could not conquer. They later on got their evens against the Persians by coming back across the Caucasus Mountains and literally defeating Darius the Great in the beginning of the end of the Medo-Persian Empire to soften it up before Alexander the Great came. And the Scythians and Alexander the Great entered into treaties, and this was their territory. We still got a lot to say about them. I was reading you the other night the record of Tiatephai. I'm going to get back to that. I'm going to get back to Ireland in the very near future. There are some basic facts that I want you to grasp. The northern tribes were carried away into bondage, the final thrust being 722 B.C., the end of the 8th century, so the last half of the 8th century B.C., they were carried away into bondage to be settled in that place on the western shores of the Caspian Sea, south of the Caucasus Mountains, east of the Tigris River, south and east of the Black Sea. That was the territory of the Aryans, the portion of the Aryans that came to be known as the Medes. Now, the tribes of Israel were accomplished horsemen. The stables of Solomon were noteworthy throughout the world as he reigned. But they became more accomplished as horsemen as they were settled among the Medes, noted for those skills. No matter what discipline we go to, be it philology and the strange phenomenon of these Celtic and Scythian tribes picking up a form of the Greek that they write backwards. The Celtic Greek is written from right to left, like the Hebrew. A superimposition of Greek alphabet and Greek words but written backwards that ultimately became the basis for Ogham, that strange written language in Ireland. We have a monarchy breaking on the scene in Ireland, full orbed, and nobody can tell us for sure where it came from. Every indication points to an origin in that same area where the 10 tribes settled. Every source of knowledge. I'll bring in here a classic volume I have on the history of the sword. The one who wrote the book was simply following the history of the sword. But if you know the other waves of knowledge that all focus in on the same spot, you're forced to ask a question. Why a certain kind of iron sword was in use among these nomads that was later traced and discovered by the Crusaders when they encountered it at Damascus. I have a volume on horses. Had nothing to do with religion. Once again, I find myself forced to a trait that leaps out of this area around the Caspian Sea and the Scythians, the nomads of that day. I have a Scotsman friend here tonight. I'm sure he knows. Not only does the Gaelic cognate of the word Scot come from a Gaelic word that means to wander or wanderers, a synonym for nomads, but it was the Scoti from Ireland who settled in Scotland and gave it its name. The English language is credited with a Teutonic source in German. there is as much etymological similarities traced to the Hebrew as those that want to make a case for the Teutonic source. You don't put verbs at the end of the sentence in the English language. Now, if you'll study Hebrew and English at the same time, you'll find a lot more similarities in style of expression between English and Hebrew than you will between English and German. And I'll tell you this, it's easier for someone who knows English to learn Hebrew than it is to learn German. Wherever you turn, we keep being driven to a mystery that too much of the world doesn't want to face up to. I didn't choose to have scholars identify the birth of Zoroastrianism at a time forced by modern scholarship, much earlier than previous estimates have been, that put it coming out of the same area after a people taught in the teaching of Moses had already been assimilated into the territory. Now, the importance of what I'm doing, you haven't even guessed at yet. I've tried to warn the people who listen to not put me in a box. I know where I'm going. I've tried to warn the people that have perceptual sets about traditional viewpoints like British Israelism. Don't put me in that camp. Some people wondered why I stopped on the book of Romans. You that listen well know that I started on the book of Romans way, way back. And I opened the window one night teaching on Sunday night saying that we could not move on in Romans without an understanding of the two houses that God dealt with in Scripture once he separated them. Then I never came back to that subject again on Sunday night until I started teaching on the festival. Because as I went through the what is really preliminary teaching before I take on the book of Revelations verse by verse, I came to the same impasse. There is simply no way to continue teaching God's word right on these subjects without breaking down some traditions in regard to the Jews identified with the house of Israel in Scripture. And when I got in the book of Revelation, I decided, well, I gotta do it. And I decided to do it on festival and lay the foundations. I can't take you through the book of Romans. I can't take you through the book of Galatians, which is the emotional backdrop to the heartthrob of the book of Romans. How many of you know that it was the same nomadic people coming around the Black Sea and ending up settling as displaced people in Galatia that we're talking about that were the ones that Paul was ministering among? Many of you have read for years Jesus' statement about the house of Israel and paid no attention to it. I've watched Christians due to Romans 9, 10, and 11, the same butchering of Paul's frame of reference and changing it from what he was really saying, that have seen him due to Hosea and to Jeremiah and to Isaiah and to Zechariah and to Amos, because of a failure to recognize that God is dealing spiritually in some occasions and specifically and historically in other occasions, genetically in some occasions, not quite genetically in other occasions, with an ability to transfer his purpose. And the house of Israel and the house of Judah must be distinguished. And I'm going to read something to you, if I can find it in a hurry. If I can, I'm not going to look, because it took too long finding a map. It was a Jewish newspaper in an old book here written by someone very friendly to the British Israelite position, but still able to lay down the distinction between their solid basis in fact and the speculative conclusions that grow out of their factual basis. Now here it is. In the year 1879, the Jewish Chronicle, in its issue of May 2nd, writing on this subject of the lost tribes, said, "The fate of the lost 10 tribes is a mystery which is a peculiar fascination for some minds. While not a link is missing of the historical chain, so far as the remnant of the house of Judah is concerned, the Israelites who were subjugated by the Assyrian power," and this quote is not from someone friendly to their position, "while there's not a link missing in the historical chain as far as Judah is concerned, the Israelites who were subjugated by the Assyrian power disappear from the page of history as suddenly and completely as though the land of their captivity had swallowed them up. Beyond some vague reference to them in a passage of Josephus, no mention is made by any authentic writer of their surviving the destruction of their nationality. There has always been, however, an unwillingness to admit that a fate which has befallen so many nations, has overtaken the 10 tribes. Why should they have been less tenacious of life than their brethren of Judah? Nay, the scriptures speak of a future restoration of Israel, which is clearly to include both Judah and Ephraim." The problem then, still quoting the Jewish Chronicle, the problem then is reduced to the simplest form. The 10 tribes are certainly in existence. All that has to be done is to discover which people represent them." End quote. Now, I have said the fundamental reason for the teaching I'm doing, and it remains that, is to show you don't have to build a crutch under God and save his face and explain away what he said, because you can't find in history a way that it was fulfilled. God's word will stand the test, and all the teaching I'm doing on the subject is worth the energy if I do nothing but show that God remembers his word and accomplishes it. But I have a deeper purpose I haven't said until this moment. And that is to tell you, I stopped and knew what I was doing on Romans, and it was required before I could finish the teaching on Revelation that we locate and do what we're doing with God's Word, as well as locate the capacities of God in fulfilling his Word, before I can let you really understand the Apostle Paul, who wrote out of a frame of reference of knowledge that much of the Christian church has failed to recognize. I'm convinced he carried, dog-eared, if it were in book form, I'm using a ludicrous analogy, however you would mark manuscripts, I'm convinced he carried them that represented the books available to him. God taught him 3 years in the desert. But it wasn't some angel that come down or whispered in his ear and enabled him to quote a heathen philosopher. in such a way as to tie up the Greek philosophers as he talked about the resurrection. The Didache was carried around by him. He was well aware of the apocryphal books of the Old Testament. We've canonized what we, the Protestant Church, have decided ought to be canonized. Paul was not in attendance at the church council that made that decision. It long post-dated him. And whether he had an attitude of reverence for canonicity, which I doubt, he had an ability and a proximity to the subject matter to look at them in terms of history, and he had an awareness of the state of mind which is not present in the current world, that the people that came back and formed the foundations of the kingdom of Judah restored in the land of Israel, that missed the Messiah because they didn't look for him the right way and ignored what Isaiah said and spent too much time with the apocryphal book of Enoch, other apocryphal books, and the book of Daniel in its final ultimate outcome. Jesus was aware, as his custom was. He went to the synagogue and read from the scripture that was there. He had an awareness of the lost tribes. Paul had an awareness of the lost tribes. The people of Judah had an awareness of the lost tribes and were well aware they had to be found before Messiah could come. That's part of what he shocked them with. Those that accepted him as a Messiah, his own statements about the lost house. Now, I will show you when I tie all these loose ends together, which will happen if Jesus tarries a while, that not only are we going to prove up the veracity of God's Word, we'll be able to understand not just the Old Testament, we'll understand key sections of the New Testament that have been opaque to many because of this background. So don't go putting me in a box. I know exactly where I'm going. But I'm going to keep working around the subject for a while. No matter which piece of research I get into, this was sent by some of you, The Horse in History. By the way, that's the way they used to represent Zalmoxis, which simply means Chief Moses. The supreme god represented by these Thracian Scythians just north of the Grecian city-states and the peninsula of the Grecian city-states in the area that is now Bulgaria. Around 875 B.C., that's about 100 years before they carried the Israelites into bondage, around 875 B.C., get your camera there, the Assyrians established a cavalry unit. Say it's little point? Sure it is. This supports what I've been telling you. That they early became known for their horsemanship because of what the Medes developed to the highest extent on the plateaus as the Aryans moved down. As Sargon took the city of Samaria and took 26,000 plus into bondage, 40,000 people in one record comes out of the total territory that he puts in his cavalry units. As they had moved from city to city, they followed the same practice of displacing the people and settling them in another area that he did of bringing foreigners in and settling them in the area where the tribes of Israel had been, and those are the so-called Samaritans of the New Testament. Just another little link in the chain. I haven't got time tonight to spend much time. The Celtic people. Who in the world are these mysterious Celts? Can't show you that picture. They were noted for going to battle stark naked. Now that that bit of research is released, if I have some closet watcher that publishes the magazine Playgirl, they'll be chasing celts all over the world. Now, if you want a traditional television preacher, he wouldn't even mention the name of that magazine without washing his mouth out and falling prostrate before God in front of you on the television. In the story of every country and every region of the world, there exists a twilight zone, a period of half-light that precedes the full dawn of history. I don't think this is a religious thing. A mysterious self. They didn't tell me what they copied this from. Whoever gave it to me, but it looks like something like out of a Time Life type or encyclopedic type article on the celts. In the story of every country and every region of the world, there exists a twilight zone, a period of half-light that precedes the full dawn of history. For history with its names of peoples and of kings is known. For history with its names of peoples and of kings, its known sites of battles, its dates and descriptions, starts when written records are first made. For the period before contemporary records, we have only such lays and legends, folk traditions and genealogies, myths and customs, as were current at the time of the first historians, and of them only as much as those historians thought worth recording. I started many weeks ago saying, you know, religious people get accused of somehow being non-intelligent faith beings. Science isn't anchored on that solid a rock either. In fact, as I showed you last night at the closing, the continents are supposed to be drifting now by some guy's bright idea. We know these myths and legends contain some truth and some poetic invention, but we seldom know which is which. Nowhere is this twilight zone more tantalizing. And we're on a detective journey. How many figured that out? Nowhere in this twilight zone more tantalizing is it more tantalizing than in the hinterland of Europe. Here north of the Alps and the Balkans, history dawns with the expansion of the Roman Empire in the first century B.C., if we look back beyond this dawn, we see in the half-light of pre-Roman Europe the vague outline of the Celts. During several centuries before the birth of Christ, while Greece and then Rome were extending their sway over the Mediterranean world, Celtic tribesmen swept across the breadth of northern Europe from the Black Sea to the Atlantic, asserting a hegemony over the native inhabitants that of that large territory wherever they could. Yet the Celts never developed a written language of their own. That doesn't mean you aren't intelligent. How many of you people know the Swiss don't have a written language? Let me see, how many didn't know that? Did you know that? Swiss don't have a written language. They ain't dumb. Boy, I'm telling you, that ought to put the bureaucrats in trouble to try to subpoena the records of those bankers. You know, they're Italian, they're German, they're French Swiss, they're other kinds of Swiss. They usually have some other languages. But Swiss, not written. And it took a religious television show to tell you that. About 500 B.C., the Greek historian Hecataeus mentions that the Greek colony of Marseille lies in the country of the Ligurians, close to the country of the Celts. That's our first written record by a Greek historian about the Celts, 500 B.C. He predated Herodotus. Some 50 years later, Herodotus, who gives us such detailed accounts of other countries and peoples of the ancient world, reports briefly that the source of the Danube is said to lie in Celtic country. Isn't that interesting? Danube, which is believed to be near Pyrene, believed to be the Pyrenees. He adds that the Celts are the most westerly of the peoples of Europe, except for the Cenetes, who apparently occupy the southern part of Portugal, and that you will meet Celts if you sail beyond the Strait of Gibraltar. What do you end up at if you go out that way and turn north? Huh? Britain and Ireland. Not very much later, the Celts erupt like a volcano into history. In 425 B.C., four tribes from beyond the Alps invade northern Italy. 35 years later, sack Rome. Now, if they were God's people, God took a little vengeance there, didn't he? What if they were? Admittedly, the Romans called these invaders Gauls, not Celts. We already been over that name. But although it's a full third of a millennium later, before Julius Caesar tells us that the tribes that the Romans call Gali call themselves Celti, pronounced in some occasions Celti. And since Julius Caesar, who wrote of the wars with the Gauls, and that's probably the fullest description of those wars with the, quote, barbarians that was anybody outside the Roman sphere. He says, though the Romans call them Gali, they call themselves Celtae or Celtae. Seems that by then the Celts were already in power north of the Alps, and they were in a state of ferment. In the 4th century B.C., Ephorus, another Greek historian, lists them as one of the great nomadic peoples of the world. You can't get back behind the 8th century. You can't get back behind 700. Now, I'm not reading a sympathetic person, because I'm going to read a sympathetic person in a moment to the British Israelite position, which I am not. But as I've said, don't throw the baby out of the bathwater. They had some solid history that they went too far with. Gallic raids in Italy continued, and Celts from Gaul were fully settled in the valley of the Po and apparently around the head of the Adriatic, when Celtic envoys went to meet Alexander the Great when he was campaigning in Bulgaria in 335 B.C. 60 years later, all Celts erupted again. Three Celtic tribes, each with its own name, but all calling themselves Galatians, descended into Macedonia. There's not a Bible, I want you to know. Descended into Macedonia with their families and wagons in the middle of the winter of 280 B.C., not too long before Christ, looting and seeking to settle. In the following year, they sacked Delphi, but were defeated and crossed to Asia Minor, where after, you know what, Asia Minor takes them into Turkey, where after a period of widespread raiding, they settled down in the region of present-day Ankara, a region that received the name Galatia, to which Paul wrote his epistle. This raid of 279 B.C. appears to have been a venture of desperation by a tribal confederacy forced to find a new place to settle. It was the last act of Celtic aggression in the area. For the next 200 years, the Celts were on the defensive, gradually losing ground In 225 B.C. at Telamon, the Romans decisively defeated the Celts, or the Gauls as they continued to call them, of northern Italy, and their confederates north of the Alps. And in 192 B.C., Rome extended her rule over the Gauls of the Po Valley. Nearly 70 years later, in 124 B.C., the Romans conquered Provence, the area closest to Italy inhabited by the Gauls beyond the Alps. And nearly 70 years after that, in 58 B.C., Julius Caesar began the seven-year campaign that reduced the whole of Gaul to a Roman province. In Caesar's famous description of Gaul at the time of his campaigns, in the 50s of the first century, he divides Gaul into three parts: the southwest, inhabited by Aquitani; center, inhabited by the Celts; the northeast, inhabited by the Belgae. So much do we know of the Celts from classical sources. Clearly, they were the major power in Europe during the classical period, when the Greeks defeated the might of the Persian Empire at Marathon, while Pericles was building the Parthenon, when Alexander the Great campaigned to India, while the Romans were warring against Carthage and establishing their empire around the Mediterranean. All this time, north of the Alps, the Celts were dominant and were undoubtedly waging wars just as great and just as significant as those to the south. They had no historians, and their wars were forgotten, historians in the sense of writing it down. But for at least 500 years, they held sway from the Carpathians to the Pyrenees, and raided and even settled, when the opposition was not too strong, in Spain, Italy, Greece, and Asia Minor. Isn't it interesting that those Galatians? Now, do you understand why Paul is so upset when a bunch of Judaizers go in there and try to get him to go back behind Christ? Now, maybe this is the time to tell you. Do you know what is translated nations in the Old Testament when it talks about the nations that Ephraim and Manasseh are to become? You know what the word is in the Hebrew? It's the same dang word that is translated in other places, Gentiles. I'll be darned, somebody said over there. Now, for years, people think that there are Jews and Gentiles. There are. That's it. God divides the whole world now between Jews and Gentiles. The problem has been that confused people have taken the word Jews, that applies only to Judah and their descendants and those that they adopt, and had it include Ephraim, Israel, and Samaria. If you continue to try to find the 10 lost tribes with the characteristics of a Jew, you'll never find them, because they aren't Jews. You got that? In fact, God never said that Ephraim would produce a multitude of Jews. Now, maybe you will understand why that God, in his provision, had old Jacob adopt as two sons of his half Egyptians. Does that ring any bells in your head for a minute? God always gives you his little clues as he goes along. Now, there are people that are looking for a little old bitty tribe of Jews hunkered down somewhere, afraid the world will discover they're Jews. The house of Israel will become a multitude of Gentile nations. Now, that doesn't mean they are no different from anybody else in all respects. Yeah, they are. They are the descendants of the ten tribes. By the same token, there is a specific promise genealogically traced. The seed of David must sit on the throne over God's people, whether they know who they are or not. Second, do you know there's a difference between the covenant given to Abraham and the covenant given to Moses? That's the whole purpose of what Paul's arguing when he says to the Galatians, when did Abraham get the promise? Before he was circumcised or after he was circumcised? It was a promise of faith, not legality. Now, God will keep his word of promise to each link in the chain. That's why we're paying close attention to these things. And what I'm doing and have been doing for weeks is raising more questions than I have given answers. Though I'm giving a few, if you keep your ears open. But you see, God's word can give the answers. And I can't stand anybody with so little faith in God, they're scared to death that the question will make God run off and hide. These Galatians descended into Macedonia and settled in the region of present-day Ankara, a region that received the name, because of these settlers, Galatia. Well, now, is it possible that in that one case, just what if, among many things that Paul did, what if in that one case, Paul, well versed in the subject, what if in one case he did obey Jesus and take the message to the lost tribes? What if? I ain't committing this yet. After all that speech, this scholar says, now we've followed him, haven't we? The Celts. But, he says, look at it. But, another one of those buts. But who were they? But who were they? Turn the cooler off. Give me the creeps on my back. Who were they? And how did they arrive? We got that north wind blowing here tonight. The God of the ceiling is... they? Well, that's an intelligent. And how did they arise? For that matter, when did they arise? For we only know that when the first Greek historians began to write their first histories, about 500 BC, the Celts were already fully established. They may well have existed as a power long before that. They apparently had a common language. By what criteria did the Greeks and Romans distinguish the Celts from other barbaric tribesmen? Two possibilities. The Celts may have shared a common religion, and they may have had in common what archaeologists call culture. Now, oddly enough, we know a lot about the religion of the Celts. Their priests. Again and again, a three-faced god is found portrayed in Ireland and even in Denmark. In fact, the most fascinating portrayal of the deities of the Celts comes from Denmark. And he's confused. He's puzzled by it. Now, there's the great silver cauldron at Gundestrup. Gundestrup. The classical authors unanimously describe the main religious practices of the Celts as taking places in woods and sacred groves. That was their weakness. That's why they got driven out of their land. The late Professor T.G.E. Powell pointed out in this connection the significance of the word nematon, which in Celtic appears to mean a sacred wood. Now you can start going at your maps again. And which is found incorporated in important place names from Spain to Galatia. In Galatia, for example, Drunematon was the main sanctuary of the Celts in Asia Minor and must mean the sacred oak grove, using the same word for oak, Dru, that also occurs in the name of the Celtic priest, the Druids. Much nonsense has been talked about the Druids from the time when Caesar described the Druids of Gaul as members of colleges of priests who had long periods of training at seminaries. William Stukeley, 18th century surgeon and close friend of Sir Isaac Newton, even considered the religion of the Druids to be that aboriginal patriarchal religion out of which all religions derive. Their spiritual, these Druids, and supra-tribal influence was apparently of the same type as that of the oracles of Greece, which was based on a claim to be able to foresee the future, a prophetic claim, prophets. And their long period of training consisted of memorizing the genealogies and epics, which are the literature of a people without writing. The attested connection between the Druids of the Celts of Gaul and the Druids of Wales does suggest that a consciousness of underlying unity based on common language and common creeds existed over large areas despite local wars and rivalries. He then takes us to Latene, a tiny village in Switzerland. Then he says it was becoming clear that the famous Dark Age of Ireland was in fact a development of their art, appearing in the only area in Europe where the culture had not been broken off short by Roman conquest. It appears beyond reasonable doubt that the bearers of the Latene culture uncovered first in Switzerland were the Celts. And this was important, for if we could find archaeological evidence for the origins and antecedents of the Latine culture, which now clearly was the Celts, we could push back our knowledge of the history and origins of the Celts beyond the time when they first appear, fully fledged in the Greek histories of 500 B.C. Then he says we got to go back to 1000 B.C., and we find that Central Europe was occupied by people that archaeologists have called the Urnfield culture. All of a sudden, about 800 B.C., the first signs of outside interference appear among the Urnfield peoples. They guess on that date. They just pick a round figure. 7th, 8th century. Suddenly a force interferes with the aborigine Urnfield people that are the natives. Scattered among the thousands of burial urns that characterize the Urnfield people of this period are found a few, perhaps 60 in all, containing bronze horse trappings, especially bits of a remarkable type. They are remarkable because they're well known somewhere else. They are the horse bits with ornamental cheek pieces depicted on Assyrian reliefs from about the 8th century B.C. in northern Mesopotamia. Here we go again. Now, these horse trappings that were new in Assyria also how did they get here? Scythian horsemen who at this time were contending for grazing grounds north of Armenia, north of the Black Sea. It would seem that a very small number of these warrior horsemen, Sumerians, which comes from Kimri, which is a derivation of the Assyrian designation of the ten-tribe kingdom as the son of Omri, because he built the capital city, Samaria, that now finds still a modern expression in the Cymry of the coast of Wales. Please somebody tell me how to pronounce that. Scythian horsemen, a small number of these warrior horsemen, Cimmerians or Sumerians, possibly even Scythes or Scythes, one derivation of the Scyth, penetrated into Europe in this century. They were probably originally mercenaries, perhaps even veterans who left the Assyrian army. They rapidly attained positions of some prominence among the peoples whom they served, and from about 700 B.C., we find their burials. They prized horses, but they would bury their harness with the horsemen, and their long broadswords and spears of iron, for it was at this time that iron was introduced into Europe from the Middle East. The Celts made a practice. How many know what David did to Goliath? Come on. What do you do? Cut his head off. The Celts made a practice of cutting off their enemies' heads in battle. Now, the practice of these burials of the Scythians and the Celts, significantly, the site of such graves move ever westward. You can plot archaeologically an ever-moving westward movement. In the 7th century B.C., they were located in an area of the Eastern Alps. I told you where the western border was that Herodotus named. They're in the Eastern Alps. In the 7th century. One century later, in the 6th, we find them around the Western Alps, in Switzerland, the Black Forest, and Upper Rhine Valley. The latest, most westerly, and the richest of these graves date from the end of the 6th century, and it was that of a Celtic princess at Vix on the Upper Seine, or Seine. Here, the body of a woman in her early 30s lay upon a light wooden carriage ornamented with bronze. The carriage was similar to other richly ornamented wagons found in Denmark. I don't write this. The princess just mentioned was buried with all her Greek and Etruscan treasures at about the same time that Hecateus named the Celts for the first time in the Grecian history. Clearly, over the last 400 years, the Urnfield people were assimilated into the Celts. The Celtic character, the heroic, tragicomic spirit, which throughout history has been associated with the Celts. For the great Gaels of Ireland, wrote G.K. Chesterton, are the men that God made mad, for all their wars are merry and all their songs are sad. The probable richness of this lost heritage is attested to more than anywhere else in Ireland, where the cycles of lays have survived, though belonging to a later date. The Fenian cycle and the Ulster cycle, which deals with the exploits of the champions of the Red Branch, whose leader's name translates the Hound of Ulster, were first written down in the 12th century A.D. But their language is that of the 6th to the 8th centuries. This rich and colorful culture disappeared completely, except for a remnant in the westernmost fringe of the British Isles before the advance of the Roman Empire. This is no British Israelite. Not at all. At this time, too, the Scotty from Ireland invaded Scotland and gave the land their name. It is from these invasions rather than from the surviving Celtic natives, that the Gaelic language of Wales and Scotland received the impetus that enabled them to survive into modern times. Just think, Ken, one of your great granddads used to go to battle stark naked. I want to take a little pause side road for a minute. Again, I like to read things that are not necessarily sprinkled with hallelujahs and amens every other sentence. Here's the Jewish People's Almanac. Now, I think that qualifies as not being traditional Baptist or Pentecostal or British Israelite. They have a section here, Adventurer Extraordinary. Now, we also got the Khazar Kingdom, too, don't we? We got it up there. And we got old Zev, the false Messiah. I haven't gone back to him. Well, let's get another guy in here. Adventurer extraordinary in search of the lost 10 tribes. More than 75 years ago in Budapest died one of the most famous adventurers and explorers of the 19th century, a man now belatedly recognized in Israel as a forgotten Jewish genius. He was Armin Vanbury, who was born to an impoverished ultra-Orthodox family in the Hungarian town of Szentes Györgyi, in 1832. Crippled at the age of 3, Vanbury, whose original name had been Aaron Weinberg, is reported to have been converted to Islam as a youth and in later life became a Protestant, but throughout his life was known as a Jew. His diaries, manuscript, and travel notes, which is supposed to shed light on the so-called disappearance of the 10 lost tribes of Israel some 3,000 years ago, are now the property of the Budapest National Library and Archives. Now, I'm going to skip over his study of Turkish dialect, Biblical Hebrew, Arabic, his search for the Bukhara Jews. I'm going to skip over what I want to read to you later and just simply say this. Now, Vanbury had a perfect command of 12 European and 22 Oriental languages. That isn't bad, is it? Let's read that again. Perfect command of 12 European and 22 Orient. That's just in case somebody is listening and thinks that the only people interested in this subject are crackpots. I wonder how many are reading the news every night from a idiot card that have 12 European and 22 Oriental languages. You ever notice how they don't really look at you? It's just a little bit off of the camera. They can't even memorize a half hour news thing that they trade off with four other people. Now, Vanbury had perfect command of 12 European and 22 Oriental languages. He produced 17 books on Oriental languages and 29 volumes on Central Asian politics, economics, folklore, and anthropology. I like smart people. Perhaps his most unique piece of writing is an unpublished 919-page manuscript on the lost 10 tribes of Israel. Now, what if we... A work in his own handwriting. It rests to this day in a vault in the Budapest National Library. Vanbury's travel notes and diaries turned out to have modern political value when Soviet intelligence agents studied them before infiltrating Afghan and Persian border tribes at the close of World War II in an attempt to seize the industrial diamond field in Natima. Think that these biblical subjects haven't got some drama to them? I mean, I wish those people write movies. Come around and ask a few questions of me before they ruin a good movie like The Lost Ark by having broken tablets in it instead of the unbroken ones. He has long since been forgotten. But whatever the value of his theories, Aaron Weinberg, better known as Armin Vanbury, who died in 1913, deserves at the least a belated entry into the roster of Jewish adventurers and explorers, I'd say. Well, you know, here's the last Chinese Jew is hiding out in Taiwan. My Lord. Let's save Armin Van Bury. I'll dog ear that, and we'll get to that later, too. Are you ready? Now we got Lyard, and we got Van Bury, and we got the Khazars, and we got Tiatefi. Oh, I tell you, you know who the Olamfala was? Don't you remember the Olamfala? He was the prophet, teacher, advisor to King Hermon. You know what Olam means? You know what Olam means? I'll tell you later. Josephus, who wrote in the first century A.D. on the antiquities of Judah or the Jews, is at great pains to remind us. I owe Ken Connolly for this book. He gave it to me, and it's a good one, Ken. I mean, you ruined a few hours of my day, but Josephus, who wrote in the first century A.D. on the antiquities of Judah or the Jews, is at great pains. Now, he didn't give me this book as something he was propounding. He just pulled it out of his ancient library. And I really value this. Josephus, who wrote in the first century A.D. on the antiquities of Judah or the Jews, is at great pains to remind his readers in the 14th chapter of his 9th book that the 10 tribes of the Israelites were entirely removed when Samaria was taken and transplanted into Media and Persia, other nations of the Assyrian Empire taking their place in Palestine. In a later chapter of his Antiquities, the 5th of the 11th book, the same historian tells us that in the days of Ezra, it was only the house of Judah or the Jews who availed themselves of the privilege of returning to their land, while the entire body of the people of Israel remained. His word is kata koran, which means when kata is in front of something, it puts an ultimate nature to it. The entire body, the finality of the statement is, the entire body, that's to those that think that those northern tribes somehow matriculated downward into Nebuchadnezzar's empire and piggybacked on the Jews when they came back under Zerubbabel and Joshua in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. No, they didn't. Josephus says, the entire body of the people of Israel remained where they were. Wherefore, he says, it follows as a consequence that there are but, this is Josephus, two tribes in Asia and Europe subject to the Romans, while the 10 tribes are beyond Euphrates still. I read this to you a few weeks ago directly from Josephus. Only two tribes subject to the Romans, while the 10 tribes are beyond Euphrates still. By the way, do you know that the Chronicles in the Old Testament were written after the Jews came back, as described in Ezra and Nehemiah? Just because in the King James they come in front of Ezra and Nehemiah doesn't mean that's when they were written. The books of 1st and 2nd Chronicles were written after the Jews came back from 70 years of bondage. They were written after Daniel prophesied. They were written after the events of the book of Ezra, of the return, the first band under Cyrus' decree, and they came back to build the temple. And in the Chronicles, written after that fact, the writer of Chronicles, under inspiration of God, says, the tribes are still in captivity, still gone in his judgment. He didn't know where they were, but he certainly made it clear they weren't with them. So you got the Bible itself saying they weren't with the ones who came back from Babylon. Well, here's Josephus saying it's clear up to his day. Now, they were beyond, and he says they're beyond the Euphrates still, a great multitude whom no man can number. Josephus had still sufficient regard for the sacred writings of his nation to let his thoughts dwell hopefully upon the glorious anticipation of the prophets. If those prophets were inspired, he knew that Israel must be multitudinous. As a historian, he was aware that the tribes led captive by the Assyrian emperors more than a century before the king of Babylon laid waste Jerusalem had never returned from their captivity. They were beyond the Euphrates. Now, the Euphrates formed the eastern boundary of the Roman Empire. Its total course is 1,200 miles. Two-thirds of this distance from the mouth of the Persian Gulf to the neighborhood of Aleppo, it scarcely deviates from a straight line pointing north and west. At this point, its course runs at right angles and follows exactly the opposite direction to its source amid the mountains of Armenia, just between the Caspian and the Black Sea. Now, the scene of the captivity of Israel was the modern Persian province of Azerbaijan from the adjoining southwestern shoreline of the Caspian. Names which may be met with today in the map of Persia are practically identical with those of the places to which, according to the several scriptural narratives, the ten tribes were deported. Thus, Haru, between Tabriz and the coast. See if I can find this thing again. Haru, between Tabriz and the coast. Find you another map with Tabriz on it. Here we are. Here's the Caspian Sea, where I had you before. Here's Tabriz. Between Tabriz and the Caspian Sea, that first little city. I was going to have them all marked, but I ran out of time. You interrupted me. Thus, Haru, between Tabriz and the coast, recalls Hara, which is the biblical name for it. Abha, inland from Tehran, represents Haber, written by the Septuagint version, Ebor. Alamut, in the mountain range of Demavin, reminds us of Hala, in the Septuagint, Alae. While the only river of Upper Persia which finds its way into the sea, at present known as Uzan, but in the 10th century A.D. as Gozan, is undoubtedly, in the opinion of the great Hebrew authority Yule and others, that the river of Gozan, by whose banks the captive Israelites were placed, is the present Uzan. And I located it, had time to get it, as Ahar is Haber, and Gozan is the river that flows down here into the delta, was Uzan is the river Gozan. So we have no trouble from biblical geography locating where these people were settled. Here also were situated the cities of the Medes. The Jews were carried captive more than a century later, that's Judah, to a country separated from the Assyrian possessions in Media by several hundred miles, the northwestern boundary of Persia. As of Media in ancient times is the river Aras, anciently Araxes, which flows eastward into the Caspian Sea from the highlands of Armenia, overlapping there for about 150 miles the upper waters of the Euphrates. South of the Araxes, then, and behind the upper waters of the Euphrates, the, quote, lost ten tribes of Israel were located at the close of the 8th and commencing the 7th century. That's the time nobody can figure out where the Celts and the Scythians came from, which simply means nomads. Where are they now? Some people believe they remained in that self-same region until the Edict of Cyrus, then returned with the Jews, being undistinguishable from the Jews today. Others that their descendants inhabit the mountains of Assyria at the present moment. The testimony of Josephus is sufficient answer to the first. They didn't come back with the Jews. No one can read the first chapter of Hosea, and I agree with him, but I'll skip over that, and say that they came back with the Jews. The first half of the 7th century B.C., I told you this last night, was the epoch of the Median Revolution against the supremacy of Assyria. Shortly before the year 650, halfway into the 7th century, the revolution was definitely successful. Till then, the one nation was continuously under the arms against the other, and anarchy prevailed. That Israel would readily seize the opportunity to escape is the only thing possible and logical to believe. That Israel actually did leave the land of her captivity and go forth to seek afresh her fortune in the world is the explicit testimony of the one only tradition of their fate which past ages have handed on to us. This tradition is recorded in the following passage of the Apocrypha, and I read it directly to you the other night. 2 Esdras, chapter 13, verses 40 to 46. These are the 10 tribes, he says, which were carried away prisoner out of their own land in the time of King Hoshea, when Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, led away captive and carried them over the waters, and so came they into another land. But they took this counsel among themselves, that they would leave the multitude of the heathen. Let me tell you something. Paul had access to 2 Esdras. We may not canonize it, and I'm not quarreling with that, but it is as good a history as Herodotus, Pliny, or Tacitus. They took this counsel among themselves, that they would leave the multitude of the heathen and go forth into a further country where never mankind dwelt, that they might there keep their law, which they had never kept in their own land. And they entered into Euphrates by the narrow passages of the river. For the Most High then showed signs for them and held still the flood till they were passed over. For through that country, as up through the Caucasus Mountains, there was a great way to go, namely of a year and a half. And the same region is called Arsareth. Then dwelt they there until the latter time. Here then, end of the quote. That ends the quote of 2 Esdras. Here then is a distinct assertion of the escape of the Israelites, leading them from Media across the upper waters of the Euphrates into the then thinly populated regions of the northwest. It is to the northwest that traces are found of the name Arsareth, which name some commentators, not realizing its meaning and wishing for something to them intelligible, have corrected to Aretseth, which signifies in Hebrew lands. To say that the region in which a migrating people settled was called lands would be an ultra-poetical way of indicating that they wandered through many centuries, and I mean through many countries. But there's no need to resort to any such conjectural interpretation of the text. The name as it stands is not difficult to understand. For Ar is the Greek transliteration of two Hebrew words meaning severally hill or city. And Sereth may well be a local name, so that the whole may mean either the hill or city of Sereth. To this day, one of the tributary streams flowing from the Carpathian Mountains into the Danube near its mouth is the river Sereth. Near its source among the mountains is a city, Sereth. The river itself drains a district some 300 miles in length by 50 miles in breadth. Why not this region, the Arsareth, or hill or city of Sereth, of Esdras? But through that country there was a great way to go, Esdras said, namely of a year and a half, and the same region is called Ar, city or hell, a city or hill rather, Sareth, hill of Sareth or city of Sareth. Still one there. Still a river there. About the year 650 B.C., judging from the chronology of the Lydian and Median monarchies, that I'll get to when I go back to Lollard's diggings at Nimrud, furnished from the historian Herodotus, the date about 650 B.C., the great Scythian nation, which had for some time previously been settled south of the Araxes, which is in exactly the area I just showed you on the map, east of the Caspian Sea, south of the Caucasus Mountains, and penetrated the passes of the Caucasus, and skirting the often frozen shoreline, migrated into Europe, settling immediately in the land of the Cimmerians on the northwest of the Black Sea, called by some the land of the Cimmerians, which is but a transliteration of the way the Assyrians designated the 10 tribes as the son of Omri. So we have them designated as Cimmerian land, settling at Arsareth, a tributary near the mouth of the Danube, which flows into the Black Sea, north Bulgaria. And they were a people of such prowess that many legends clustered about their name and were doubtlessly continually being enlarged upon by the Grecian traders who encountered them. According to themselves, the Scythians were one of the youngest of nations. They come on the scene between 700 and 650 B.C. Darius, in a heathen inscription dug up by the archaeologists, records that these 10 tribes of Israel rebelled against their Assyrian overlords, causing much trouble about 50 to 55 years after they were carried into bondage. 722 is the date of being carried into bondage. That means 670 or thereabouts, the rebellion would begin. To 660 at the latest. 650 B.C., they appear north of the Caucasus, and 2 Esdras says they passed for a year and a half through that gate, sometime called the Sarmatian, as some would pronounce it, Sarmatian gate, to come close to Samaria. Those who lived nearest to Greece, the Getae, were Herodotus is full of their history and their views and customs. Those who lived nearest to Greece, the country of Herodotus, the Getae, were confident, he tells us, that their God was the true God, and that there was mortality, or rather immortality, beyond the grave. Moreover, these were the noblest and most just of all the people occupying the Thracian peninsula. The Scythians, generally, Herodotus says, were an exception to the unpolished character of the surrounding nations. The poet Aeschylus speaks of them as, quote, ruled by good laws. Thucydides, writing about 420 B.C., says that in respect of military strength, no single nation either in Europe or Asia could match them. Herodotus adds, quote, they have in one respect, and that the very most important of all that fall under man's control, shown themselves wiser than any other nation, possessing no houses but wagons, and carrying these about wherever they go, how can they fail of being unconquerable and even unassailable? Those who dwelt nearest to Greece, it was testified of them, they believed in one unseen supreme deity. They made booths like the Israelites. Describing their sacrifices, Herodotus says, after flaying the beasts, they take out all the bones and put the flesh into cauldrons. Then, placing the bones of the animals beneath the cauldron, they set them alight and so boil the meat. Professor Rawlinson, no British Israelite, I can tell you, connects this custom with the Israelitish usage described in Ezekiel 24, verse 5, quote, take the choice of the flock and burn also the bones under it, and make it boil well. End of the scripture quote. So too the following from Herodotus, the Greek historian. Scythia has an abundance of soothsayers, who foretell the future by means of a number of willow wands. This has its counterpart in Hosea 4:12. the prophecy of all prophecies to the lost tribes, the people that were named by Hosea as being placed by God in a position where they would be known as not my people. Hosea 4:12 says, quote, my people ask counsel of their stocks for their limbs, and their staff declareth unto them. A later writer, Posidonius, quoted in Strabo 7, chapter 7, 3, speaking of the southern Scythians, says that they actually abstain from animal food from religious motives. Herodotus further adds, fourth of his record, 63, that they never use swine, the unclean animal of the Hebrews, in their sacrifices. Nor, quote, indeed is it their wont to breed them in any part of their country. Among all their graves are inscriptions and items identifying them from the epoch and the territory, the epoch of their captivity and the territory of the Assyrians. If their national and religious characteristics serve in any way to link the Scythians of Herodotus with the vanished tribes of Israel, the record of their achievements goes far to confirm this association. In the year B.C. 628, the Scythian... I'm going to stop right there. I want to show you something. The Scythians, closest to Greece, were the Thracians. I've shown you this before. I bring it out again to put it in the context of what's just been read. Here's a map of the Thracian territory. This is no religious book. This is a solid archaeological study of the digs and what they've revealed about Thrace and the Thracians. Here's their map. I showed it to you before. This is where they settled around the Black Sea. The Getae, that's the tribe that you just heard Herodotus refer to. But south of them was the tribe that called themselves Moesi, reaching over to the Hebrus River. They worshipped a god, Zalmoxes. They all had this common hero god. And this hero god was sometimes portrayed on a horse. Here he is. Here's the hero representative on the horse and with a spear. And many times the motifs show him killing a pig in a religious frame, killing the pig. The mixtures of the religion I'll come back to in the Thracian area. Again and again, and I'm getting serious, I tease you lots. Occasionally. But again and again, I'm asking the only people I can see. Lots of you tune in, you haven't listened. I even had my good attorney friend, Ed Masry, tune in the other night. He said, I lost him a couple of times. I said, you haven't been listening, Ed. That gives you away. Because I've been covering the ground like a hammer hitting. And wherever we turn, whatever the source, which is the purpose, and would produce the gestalt that I'm seeking, an insightful conclusion that is irrelevant, in a sense, to the detail. I don't expect you to remember the detail. Again and again, from every source, one message is coming forth. The word Scythian, that means nomads, as Scoti means nomads, are traced to a band of people called the Qumri, Cimmerians, that were called by their Assyrian captives or capturers. They were called the son of Omri because the last city to fall under Sargon was Samaria, and Omri, the sixth king of that kingdom, had put the capital in Samaria, and as Sargon, in his own records, conquered it, Thereafter, they were referred to as the people or house or son of Omri, which butchers itself in the oral transliteration into the Sumerians and the Qumri and the Kimri. And that suddenly on the scene appear an advanced people, masters of the warfare as horsemen, because they were made mercenaries in the Assyrian army, set by Darius to rebel somewhere around, if his date is correct, 650 to 660 BC, said by Esdras, who had no occasion to exaggerate. He was the agent in the court of the king, gaining permission from Nebuchadnezzar to invite them to return under Nebuchadnezzar's more benevolent reign, as the Jews had done, back to their homeland. But they took counsel among themselves and decided to depart to a land unknown, and for a year and a half, he records, they went through the Caucasus Mountains. And archaeology and history everywhere locates them as appearing full-orbed on the historical scene, advanced in law, with a belief in a supreme God and immortality, with characteristics that trace themselves to the Assyrian area of their captivity and to the teachings of Moses. And they are swept as the Huns and the Mongols and the others that moved into northern Europe. They're driven ever north and westward. And finally, the last remnant, as we've already read by this scientist earlier, end up in the British Isles, in Ireland, where we have already pointed out the strange characteristic of these people is their tendency to use circular type dwellings. It's one of the characteristics that leaps out of any study of the Celts, is their circular type dwellings. It's what separates them from their predecessors in the area. I may have a picture of it here that I can show you. There's living like the Celts. Now, they had that same characteristic in building their fortifications. Their stone forts. The greatest of the earthen fortifications all over Ireland, wherever you turn, Dun, I don't know whether I can pronounce the word the proper way, but I can get the Dun right, Dun and Gusa, Dun O'Nocht, Dun O'Keel, Dun Connor. What are these? Round fortresses all over Ireland, giving the impression of a people who have finally found their last outpost. There's no further place to go. From Ireland, it's the Atlantic Ocean. With no further place to go, they must form their last stand in these round fortresses. Well, isn't it interesting? Dun. And the language, as you know, that they carried with themselves from their ancestors had no vowels in it. Dun could just as easily be Dan, Don, Dun, Din, Din. Or it could be D-N, or it could be Dun. It simply means, like Jordan, which means spreading judgment. And the name for Irish judges, long before anybody with any Christian frame of the Bible or any Jews from Judah arrived, Duns. And these forts all over Ireland, Duns, which could just as easily be called Dans. Now, this doesn't cause you to begin to say, there's too much, and that's the only audience I got. because I want to start getting down to the nitty-gritty in the rest of the week here. Is it or is it not an overwhelming, you that have sat here night after night, an overwhelming avalanche, all of which comes up with the same conclusion? Yes or no?
Yes, sir.
Now, remember I said, did you know what Olam is? The Psalter of Tara was a book of chronicles of the Irish kingdom. I'm reading through this book the things I checked out in other places. Originated at Tara by one Olam Falla, who also summoned there for the first time in Irish history. Now, I brought the fairy faith here a few weeks ago. Remember that? Olam Falla's in there. It is not a book about San Francisco. It's a book about Ireland. Who also summoned there for the first time in Irish history an assembly of the heads of the people, which is considered, in Haverty's History of Ireland, to be one of the earliest instances of a national convocation or parliament in any country. Now, we left Jeremiah down in Egypt. Then I jumped a little to a little poem I read you the other night that Tiatephi put together of the bards of Ireland that left the old prophet at one of the stopping off places just before they headed toward Spain. I'm just sort of jumping ahead right here. If parliaments were unknown in the West at that early time, they were not unknown in the East. For in the wilderness, Moses associated such an assembly with himself for judicial purposes. And when Saul was elected king of Israel, it was in a parliament of his fellows. Besides the establishment of the triennial assembly, Haverty continues, this is a carnal historian, for want of a better way to put it, Olam Falla appears to have instituted wise regulations for the government of the country. Over every 100 he appointed a chieftain, and over each townland a kind of prefect, all being servants of the King of Ireland, but a thoroughly Hebrew institution. Maximized under David. This Olam Falla, we learn from the annals of the four masters, McGeoghegan's translation, we learn this Olam Falla is celebrated in ancient history as a sage and legislator, eminent for learning, wisdom, and excellent institutions. His historic fame has been recognized, listen close, by placing his medallion in basso relievo with those of Moses and other great legislators on the interior of the dome of the four courts in Dublin. He was not a king. Chroniclers have confused the prophet with the king, who was associated with him in his reforms. Mr. Glover quotes from his monumental work out of the edition of Lynch's Cambrensis Verses by Dr. Kelly, professor of history at Maynooth, to the effect that Heramone, the king who is regularly confused with him in Irish annals, gave Ulster to Olam Falla. So Heramone was the king, Olam Falla the wise statesman and legislator. In order that his work might be perpetrated, he founded also at Tara. That only began to be called Tara when this strange foreign prophet with a servant named Simon Breck arrived with a daughter of Pharaoh, or in some cases called the daughter of a Spanish king in some of the bards, and married Heramone, and this wise old prophet with her exacted two things, the changing of the name of the High King's location in Ireland to Tara, and that a school of the prophets, or Olam, Mur Olam, might be founded. In order that his work might be perpetrated, he founded at Tara a fair palace for the learned sort of the realm, denominated Mer Alman or Mur Olam, or Mur Olam Han, House of the Wise Man, or translated School of the Prophets, himself being the Ard Olam, or Chief Prophet. Olam then was his title. Now here we're way up in Ireland. Now Olam is a Hebrew word denoting the timelessness of eternity and the invisibility of God. Mr. Glover quotes a letter from a Jewish friend who, writing on the Hebrew word Olam, says, if the word was spoken as relating to man, it would simply imply that he was a possessor of hidden knowledge which was not common to man generally. Olam may not unreasonably be traced to the Hebrew flay or fail, used of all that is wonderful. Therefore, the Irish legislator's title bears the certain Hebrew rendering of a possessor of knowledge, hidden knowledge, analogous to prophet, and the possible Hebrew rendering of the wonderful seer or the wonderful prophet, as the stone wonderful is Leophael. Mur Olam Han, the name of his college, bears the significant meaning in Hebrew of the precinct of the seers, while Terah, the name of the hill, has been traced to either the location of the town where Jeremiah and the king's daughters fled into Egypt, or a possible transliteration and corruption of the Hebrew word Torah for law. As to the date of this great legislator's, lots of debate. The earlier epics assigned events in Irish legendary history, but now rejected by critics. Dr. Kelly, the Maynooth professor, quote, informs us touching the disputed dates in connection with the illustrious Olam Pala that the time of his existence had by the balance of deduction of the most, and Dr. Kelly's no British Israelite, had by the balance of the deduction of the most learned and dispassionate of their scholars been brought to approximately 583 B.C., Based upon this deduction, King Cymbeloth of Ulster, the certainty of whose epoch all seems to accept, died in 353 B.C. Olam Pala, in their records, is stated to have preceded him by 230 years. So the debates of Olam Pala disappear in the location of a benchmark, which is King Cymbeloth of Ulster. Thus, 353 plus 230 equals 583 B.C., the most certainly known date of Olam Pala, which corresponds exactly to the near years of the departure of Jeremiah from Judah to Egypt, and then his disappearance from biblical literature. Now, I haven't said or really focused in on the trail of the tribe of Dan yet. I just hinted at it, remember? I also haven't really told you how Jeremiah got there, if he did. You know there's a place in Ireland that they point to with pride as the grave of Jeremiah? Do you know that? You won't find one in the Holy Land. And this is an interesting book I picked up today. Here's Benjamin of Toledo's fantastic 12th century book. He's the one that looked for the lost tribes all over, between him and that other 20 language man. But you know, here's something I'll bet you never ever associated with Jews. Now I know that, and I have so many friends among them, they'll understand the twinkle in my eye and the smile when I say it. I've heard them called pirates. But it's never been put quite this way. Jewish buccaneers in the Spanish Main. There it is. Jewish buccaneers in the Spanish Main. I've been reading about them. I didn't know they were a bunch of pirates. I find this fascinating. the most southerly Jewish congregation on earth. Got so much to read, I'm going to go home. How should Jews behave on the moon? That's what it says. I mean, I don't know any almanac for Christians that tells them how to behave on the moon. But I can't wait to read about Vanbury. Perfect command of 12 European and 20... I already read about him. I can't wait to read it to you. He set out by boat and on horseback for the foothills of the Caucasus, attaching himself to one of the pilgrim caravans. Vanbury wound a green turban around his head, abandoning his walking stick and deliberately leaning on his crippled leg so that the pain became unbearable and he fainted. Vanbury was able to convince the Moslem populace that he indeed was a dervish. Thus disguised, he made his way to the forbidden cities of Central Asia in his search. At the time of his visit, there were some 80,000... I'll finish that later. Are the American Indians a lost tribe of Israel? Now, you know the Mormons believe that. And they're respected. Here's what the Jews have to say about it. But the one that I thought I might get to, but it looks like I can't. The secret Jews of Iran. We're getting down to the point where I am going to start tying the knots on some of these, as we did tonight on the Scythians and the Celts. It is overwhelming. If you want to know what I think, I am totally convinced. From the research here that I've shared with you and much more, I am totally convinced that the Qumri, called Beth Qumri, House of Umri, by the Assyrians, that the Scythians, though the word has a generic meaning of nomads, and I'm sure there were others that assimilated to them and other nomadic groups, because the Medes and the Persians themselves, as Aryans, came on the scene as nomads first. The particular band of people that came to be known as the Celts and the Scythians, north of the Caucasus, occupying that rectangular block of land that Herodotus identified, if you draw a line from Moscow to Warsaw and down to the Black Sea and across the Caucasus Mountains to the Caspian Sea, I am totally convinced that the heart, leadership, and thrust of those people represented that band that Esdras spoke of, that took counsel, having rebelled against the Assyrians, seeing the country begin to fall apart, aware when they got the invitation from Esdras that if they took the invitation and went back to their homeland, they would be under the dominion of Darius, the Persian who was unifying, or Cyrus, the Persian who was unifying the Medes and Persians and closing in on the Chaldean Empire at the time, or they would be under the dominion of the present ruler that was dominating, Nebuchadnezzar, and to be a permissive vassal in their homeland of Nebuchadnezzar, knowing that the Assyrians had already settled all the towns of their kingdom with displaced people. They took counsel among themselves and chose to move north through the mountains to an unknown land. I am convinced that the record of Esdras is an accurate historical record. They went through the Caucasus Mountains. They became the nomads characterized by Herodotus as having no certain dwelling, and they are the Scythians that settled Bulgaria to become the Thracians, the Jetai, the Moesi tribe. I am totally convinced it's their remnant that settled in Galatia, to whom Paul ministered and wrote the Galatian letter. They are of the Gentiles. Don't look for Jews. They won't call themselves Jews. God said through Hosea, they will be known as not my people. and not having obtained mercy, their scripture would be limited to the writings of Moses or the record of what Moses had to say. Their memory would go back to the Davidic kingdom when they were united. But if you will think for just a moment, when David was crowned by the people, though Samuel's promise included all of God's people in the back to the Bible, when David was crowned, if you'll read the record, and I'll give it to you next time I teach, when David was crowned, it says he was crowned first as king of Judah, over the house of Judah. And Israel sought to crown, and did temporarily crown, the son of Saul as king over Israel. And the warrior aid to become strong under David sided with David and told David that he would take care of the son of Saul. And then and only then does the whole kingdom unite under David, to you that know your Bible. That division that goes clear back to the prophecy in Ezekiel 23 of the unfaithful sisters in Egypt who learned the idolatry there that came out at the foot of the mountain when Moses was on Mount Sinai, that are separated in blessing between the birthright and the scepter people and divide as a kingdom, who precede Judah in bondage, took counsel, went north, remembering their heyday under Moses with a mixture of their Canaanitish worship, their Assyrian habits, and their Mosaic traditions. They move across Europe, and in God's own ironic vengeance, the Persian kingdom and the Roman kingdom, in the period of their greatest strength, felt the impact of defeat from these warriors that regained their strength on the steppes of southern Russia and across the plains and lower mountains of Europe, to finally be followed by waves of invaders, Attila the Hun and successors, and the pushing up from the south of the Roman Empire, and to find their last settlements in the islands of the northwest, Scandinavia and the British. Did you know that there is solid evidence that Odin was a historic person, not just a Norse god? And there is some strong evidence that traces his genealogy to a Hebraic origin. Do you know that? You know who Odin is, don't you? The Norse god Odin? Oh, it's too late.